Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as, placing the podcasts on the radio show's page at that very same website, richarddugan.com, as well as on SoundCloud and iTunes. We are on Facebook and we are on Twitter. But it's like I know the basic operations of an automobile. I'm able to operate my Volvo fairly well. But Facebook and Twitter are kind of like owning, either one of Elon Musk's rockets or a Lamborghini or something. I'm still trying to figure it all out. I'm a pretty smart dude, but even there are certain aspects of those things that I'm still working on. But we are here, and we are glad that you are there listening. We certainly encourage you to go to our guest website. We'll be giving you that shortly. There are a number of places we're going to send you on the internet as far as our guest is concerned today, and we're very excited to have with us the author of Leading From Within. Interesting concept. Conscious Social Change and Mindfulness for Social Innovation. Gretchen Key Steidel, I want to welcome you to the program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have you've got something that is quite extraordinary, not just in the context of the book, because that's more of a codification of what you're doing and where you're going. You're the founder and you're the president of Global Grassroots. I happened to watch that video a little while ago, which is an international NGO which operates a mindfulness-based leadership program and social venture incubator for vulnerable women and girls in post-conflict East Africa. You're lecturing all over the place on conscious social change at universities, wellness institutes, organizations, and gatherings worldwide. We thank you so much for sharing with us your thoughts and ideas on this whole aspect, because as we have been searching for over the 10 years plus that we've been doing this program, but what I've been thinking about probably most of my life, but the 40 years I've been in this business and interviewing people, my father is in his late 80s, and I'm only 58, and I am not real happy with the way things are in our civilization, in our societies, in our cities, in our states, in our country, and even globally. And I can only imagine how my father must feel. And he's been around almost twice as long as I have. He was born right around the beginnings of the Great Depression in the 1930s, born in 31. As was my mother. And so they've seen a lot of change. They've seen a lot of stuff going on. I have to say that there was a glimmer of hope in one of the interviews that I did not too long ago. A gentleman who wrote a book, I think it's Love and Fear in the Middle East, having to do with this gentleman. I think he's a chaplain, but he goes there and holds interfaith gatherings. And he's talking to the youth, both Palestinians as well as Israelis. And the youth are basically saying, we're telling our parents, you want to fight like the Hatfields and McCoys for the rest of your natural existence? You go for it, because that ain't my fight. I want nothing to do with it. And that gave me a glimmer of hope that at the very least, the conflict might just die out with the eldest generation on both sides. I used to think that of our Congress back in the 70s when I watched them squabbling over this matter and that matter and hoping, okay, if these guys would just, some of these old guys would just, if these ideas would just go away. Well, you know, that was Pollyanna in a matter of speaking. But you're dealing on a whole nother level, and you're talking about doing this from the inside out, and of course, obviously, quoting Gandhi, you know, be the change you want to be. But, you know, sometimes I hear that phrase, and I'm going, I've been doing that, I've been trying, but, you know, I don't see the change that I'd really like to see, and I like to think that I'm growing and evolving and raising my consciousness by, maybe by milliliters. But I'm curious as to your observations of this timeline that you and I have been living in for I don't know how many years for you, and what it is that told you, hey, enough is enough. I want to see something better, and I want to see us thriving, all of us, not just a select few, not the 1%, 3%, whatever the percentage you want. I want us all to thrive and enjoy the life that we've been given.
It's true. It's true. I see both entrenched problems, including the ways in which we relate, as we face such steep division in this country, a lot of finger pointing and blaming, assumptions and bias, and a lot of anger and outrage, none of which is serving us to move forward in a way that's sustainable or deeply transformative. But I also see hope, too, and I'm lucky that in my work with Global Grassroots, for example, I get to work after war, where people are rebuilding, where there is hope, and just as you described from the gentleman who was working with youth in the Middle East, there is shifts that are taking, there is a shift that is taking place in communities that are eager to advance their own well-being as they want to define it, and are making very significant progress on a range of major social issues. So I see change. I also see the need for more change. Mm-hmm. And all of it, I believe, still starts with each of us individually. And it takes practice, and it takes additional work and more time to operate from a much more mindful perspective. But I think over the long term, it will allow us to understand each other better, build better relationships with each other, diagnose these issues that we want to fix with much greater understanding, and find solutions that are going to be optimal and sustain themselves over time, as opposed to just be a quick fix that gets overturned when the next group comes into power. And so we need to really be looking deeper and longer term.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's one of those things where, okay, I joke about this sometimes when I say this. My great grandmother on my mother's side, back in 1995, 96, I forget what exact year it was. She was 95 years old, and I used to joke with people, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna outlive my great grandmother," and you know. And every year that went by, and every year reunion, I would say that, and then I would say, "And she's making it really hard." And not that I wanted her to pass. She lived to be 100. So I've got 42 plus years to go. Okay. I want to accomplish something. I want to be able to look back, even though I have no kids, I want to be able to look back and say, yeah, we actually made it. We actually have a level of equity. For everybody, that nobody's left behind. If left behind, that's fine. That's their choice. But I actually watching this one video that you have up on globalgrassroots.org, having to do with these young girls and women in as you mentioned earlier, East Africa, and talking about education. Well, I am the biggest proponent of education. There are times when I want to sue the grade school and high school I went to for the lack of education. But then again. Since then, and doing these interviews with you and others and producing shows over the years, I feel as though I already have my PhD or master's in, because the subject matter that's been covered, the guests that we've had on this program and others, has just been phenomenal. And so I say, okay, I took the ball and I ran with it. They dropped it, but I picked it up and said, you know what? I'm not stopping here. I'm not going to accept. I mean, there was a point in time when I was on one of the what do they call them? One of these programs. I was receiving Social Security benefits because at the time I was legally blind, and I was between high school and college and or work. And I was grateful that it was there, but I was only on it for a short time. And I got to tell you, the rules and regulations surrounding that whole getting a check every month were so arduous that I could hardly wait to get off of it. Because I wanted more than just to get a check in the mail every month.
Right.
I wanted to do something with matter of fact, vacation. I love going on vacation when I have something to do. My wife and I went on one, and we went for a week up north to Yosemite and Nevada City the Christmas of 2016. And I think about that all the time. And boy, it was fabulous. I was never bored. I was never looking around. I need to do something. I need to get online, and I need to check the radio station, and I need to do that. No, none of that. And I want that for other people as well, that they have these, as I said at the beginning of the program, choices and knowledge of those choices. Talk to me about this aspect. I keep hearing this phrase over and over again for the last few years, but I know it's been around a lot longer than that. Mindfulness.
Right.
Talk to me about mindfulness and this whole aspect of leading within.
Well, so mindfulness, first of all, backing up to what you're describing and your, you know, eagerness to see general well-being and opportunity for all. And I think that's one of the challenges that we face in our society today is that a good friend of mine, Carrie Kelly, who runs an entity called Citizen Well, likes to point out that the wellness industry has skyrocketed over the last decade, and yet we have such a disparity between those who you would actually see as being well or having a sense of well-being and those that are still suffering and struggling. And we can't really pursue well-being unless we are including everyone in that process. And for me, one of the core tools in moving in that direction is mindfulness. So what is mindfulness? A quick definition of that is simply paying attention on purpose in the present moment. This is a definition coined by Jon Kabat-Zinn, most widely used definition of mindfulness. Paying attention on purpose in the present moment, and usually with a quality of curiosity or non-judgment. So what does that actually mean? So in this moment, I can pay attention to what I'm feeling. I might feel, you know, excited, irritated, nervous, whatever those feelings may be. I'm noticing them. I'm not beating myself up about it, but I'm just noticing that's how I feel right now. I might notice how my body, my physical nature is. It could be tired. It could be restless. It could be that I have chronic pain. Again, I'm not pushing it away. Or trying to feel a certain way. I'm just noticing what that is. And I might even notice my thoughts, the way that, thoughts can drift or we can be worrying or planning about things. We bring that level of awareness to ourselves as well as to whatever's happening around us, the people we're in conversation with, what we're observing taking place. And it's pretty simple, a concept, but it's extremely difficult, as anyone who's tried to practice meditation or mindfulness will tell you.
No.
And there was a 2010 study by some Harvard researchers that discovered and revealed that 47% of our waking hours, our minds are actually wandering. We're not actually present and aware in this moment. And so mindfulness takes practice, just like exercise does to get stronger. Mm-hmm. But mindfulness can also be looked at as a form of brain training, just like, you know, weightlifting. Mm-hmm. The more that you practice mindfulness, and there's a lot of different ways to do that, the more you actually are changing the structure and functioning of your brain. And there's enormous benefits from doing so. From a personal standpoint, it brings you great positive benefits, and it influences the way you interact with other people.
I'm sorry, were you talking to me? yes, I am paying attention. Now, but what I find interesting about this whole aspect is that mindfulness is one thing, and paying attention and listening and being in the now. I use the analogy of my software that I use for recording and editing of audio. And when you're recording, what you see on your screen is over on the right, left side of the screen, you see the wave that's being created, the voices, the sounds, the music, whatever it is. That's over on the left side. Over on the right side, nothing. There's nothing there. There's just a black area in the window. But in the center, there's this line, this center line. And that is the now, because anything to the left, which is the sound, is already past. That which is to the right, where there's nothing, nothing's been done yet. That's the future. So it's that line, and that's the analogy that I use, that's that moment. And it's difficult sometimes, as you've described, to do that. I mean, it took me a lot of years to finally get to the point where, because my dentist used to get upset with me because I wasn't doing a great job. And I used to say, I don't have the discipline to do that ritual every single day. And then it dawned on me, actually you do, because you have an alarm clock that goes off and you get up in the morning and you go and you take care of all the animals and you do this and you do that and you go to work and you do this and you do that and you go home and you do this and you do that and you go to bed and then you start it all over again. So don't tell me, and I'm speaking to myself, don't tell me you don't have the discipline to meditate.
Uh-huh.
So I take the position of Teresa of Avila, who says that God is amongst the pots and the pans, or in my case, the zeros and the ones, because I deal mostly with computers.
Mm-hmm.
But we get so easily distracted. I deleted all of the news applications from my phone, my tablet, and my computers because I got sucked into the 2016 campaign in September of that year. It took me 6 months, as I phrase it, to get unsucked. And I finally got to a place where I was able to perceive or look at the stuff from this perspective. Thank you, teacher. And I got to tell you, I had to swallow hard just to say that. Thank you, teacher, for showing me the ways that I do not want to behave. And you talk about the polarization. I listen to, because, you know, I've worked for both conservative and liberal stations, and I have no use for any of them. But what really strikes me as strange is two questions I posed to a conservative talk show host in studio once, off air. I said, first of all, don't you think you owe them, the other side, those he's complaining about, a debt of thanks and gratitude? Because without them, you'd have nothing to talk about.
Or complain about.
Or complain about. You feed them. Or they feed you. Number two is, don't you think maybe all of the problems you're complaining about that they are responsible for? That's on you, because you didn't get your people out to vote, to elect the people that you wanted, to affect the change that you wanted. So it's not them, it's you. You did this to yourself. And the other side is exactly the same. If you're complaining, and so I've wanted to send a big wheel of cheese to all of these different talk show hosts on the left and the right, saying, here is a big wheel of cheese to go with your wine, W-H-Y-N-E. And I don't see how it's productive. I really don't. I have to say that in the early 80s, when Reagan got rid of the fairness doctrine in broadcasting, that was the beginning of the end in that respect for fair and unbiased discussion. I ran into that problem working at a religious station. So we get all these distractions. I shouldn't go on any further with that. We get all these distractions. What is your technique? What is your suggestion? What are the steps that you go through or that you teach people to go through to stay in the now, to stay on that line?
Right. Well, there are kind of two different major categories of that. That I encourage people to dive into. The first is sort of a solitary practice, and the second is more informal, everyday moments of mindfulness. So from a solitary, formal mindfulness practice, there's so many different ways that you can begin this kind of brain training process, and there are meditation, for example, is one of these tools where one would take some time on their own. And I tell people, like, build it into your schedule. Like, if you are one who sets the alarm clock and then, you know, goes through one or two snoozes, well, use one of those snoozes to sit up right where you are and do a meditation until it buzzes again in 9 minutes or so. Or a coffee break. The average length of a coffee break is 7 minutes. Well, just take one of those instead for your meditation practice or as a way of calming down before you go to sleep instead of, another 10 minutes of watching some show. So that requires discipline. It requires building that into your day. And that practice can simply be watching your breath. Now, that sounds like the silliest, simplest thing you could do. But as you sit there, and, you know, I advise people to sit up straight and just notice whatever they can notice about their breath, how it feels going in and out, the temperature, the depth, the pace, how their body moves with their breath, and whether you pause or not. There's a million things you could look at with your breath. Pretty soon you'll notice your mind is wandering again. Well, then once you notice that, you bring it back to your breath. And you start to observe, oh, I'm spending, like you were saying, spending all my time in the past, or I'm spending my time in the future, but what about right now? Right now I'm breathing. And do that and see how long you can go for. Maybe count up to 10 breaths before your mind wanders, or start over again if it does. And that's all you need to do to start a mindfulness practice. Now, in your everyday, you'll notice the more you do that solitary practice, the more you actually are aware in your day-to-day. And in your day-to-day, you can also choose cues to help you become aware of that moment of now. And that could be such as, before you click send on any email, you are going to take 3 breaths and make sure you are saying what you want to say. There's few of us that have had those moments where we actually wished we did take that time before we hit send.
Oh, yeah.
Or whenever you walk through a door, or I'll walk upstairs, or hear a phone ring, you can use a cue that helps you check in with yourself and how you're feeling and notice what's going on around you. And to practice really paying attention when you're speaking with someone, instead of thinking about what it is you're going to say next, or what you're going to have for lunch, but to actually focus your attention on everything that's happening in that moment. And the more that we practice those moments of mindfulness, the more we're likely to catch ourselves when we're getting emotionally triggered by something and we're getting irritated and we're about to like snap at somebody. Being mindful gives us the capacity, and this has been studied and clinically studied, Research has shown that the more you practice this, the more you're able to turn off automatic pilot, the more you're able to not react in the ways you typically do, the more you're able to kind of draw on what is happening in that present moment to respond with greater wisdom and compassion and empathy. You're going to feel more positive emotions, and you're going to be able to have conflict with less anger. It also reduces your anxiety and stress and depression and rumination. And so overall, we tend to feel more positive emotions and we relate to better to other people better. And that's, you know, just takes practice.
Well, and that's really kind of the bottom line. And yet at the same time, if you were to be in that space, in that moment of now, that mindfulness moment of this moment, would you say everything's okay? We don't need change of any kind. I'm in the now. I'm in the moment, and all is good. I am a great person, and I I'm doing great work. And we don't need social change. We don't need to make things different because I'm in this moment. Because the only way that we know that we want change and need it is when we look into the past. How do you balance that?
That's a great question. So there is a teaching about how most of our suffering comes from wanting things to be different. So, and we do all naturally tend to want change. We want improvements in our life. We, you know, want to learn. We want to have comfort. We don't, there are things we don't want. You know, we don't want pain. We don't want suffering and sorrow or loss. And so naturally, we kind of fluctuate between kind of grasping at these things that we really hope for, that next promotion or whatever that may be, or trying to push away the things we don't want, like that 5 pounds that we can't seem to get rid of. You know, we're always in this place. And truly, you know, most of that suffering is just the plain wanting it to be different. If we could accept where we are in our lives, we may not necessarily feel so, you know, run by these emotions that come from, you know, our discomforts. However, and so there is something to be said for acceptance, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't also envision a better world or that we want to work towards change. It's just that we don't get hung up on it having to happen and feeling that our happiness has to hinge upon it. Instead, we can be much more clearly focused on what is my unique role to play in achieving that change. And if we start from with ourselves, as we go through this process of using mindfulness to kind of begin to notice our own ways of being, we start catching ourselves on automatic pilot and our own reactions, we start to see ourselves more clearly, and we are willing to work on changing ourselves. And as we do that, we also realize that change is hard. It's not easy to change yourself. And so on the other end of the spectrum, from acceptance is this angry, like blaming, pointing fingers, divisive side of saying it's your fault. And instead of doing that, we have compassion because we've gone through and we're going through an evolving, changing process for ourselves. We start to realize that it's hard for other people to change their behavior and that we all come into our lives having been conditioned in certain ways to believe certain things from our childhood, and that, you know, we all have work to do. So I think it is not about plain accepting and being okay with how everything is. We recognize reality, but we also recognize we have a role to play in shifting and changing it, and that we all do. And it's not 100% up to us, but it is also not 100% up to somebody else. And so we can, with a much more balanced viewpoint, engage in a way that is actually going to be constructive.
One of the things that I shared just a little bit ago had to do with the whole aspect of the kind of dialogue that's going on in the media, in this country specifically, on a political level. And there was an incident with a woman who was at the this annual event the president refuses to attend now for the second straight year. And she made some people felt were maybe, I don't know, off color or inappropriate jokes. But then she made the comment that she said, hey, you know, you guys should have done a better job in vetting me before you hired me for this gig, because basically she was saying, this is the way that I am. And that was, to me, it was a great line, because I thought, yeah, you know, not only when we're talking do we need to know our audience, but when you're hiring someone to speak to an audience, you need to know your presenter. Then the other thing that occurred to me was, you know, they were criticizing her for the way that she was speaking and how disrespectful and this and that and the other thing. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm sorry. You don't seem to understand. The president opened this door during the campaign in 2015, and she just walked through it. And at the same time, I sit here and I go, how is any of this helping? How is any of this really fostering any kind of, I want to say, positive change? Change towards a more creative and inclusive community and society. How is any of this helping? The radio shows, television shows, talking heads and so forth, who on both sides or on all sides, who are just blasting the other side. I mean, we might as well be at literal war with one another, a civil war, because I've always believed, I don't know about you, Gretchen, words have power. And some people will say, oh, come on, Richard, don't be so naive. It's just politics. No, it's not. You used the words that you used to, in the case of politics, to get the office that you're sitting in now. So there was an intent there. And we talk about that a lot on this program as well, about intent, about the purpose behind what you're saying and why you're saying it. Talk to us about that in the relationship between where we are today and where you'd like to see us tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
Well, I think you're right. Intent is critically important, and we're not always aware of that intention, or when we are, sometimes it's hidden from the way in which we present ourselves. And if we are operating authentically and transparently with good intention that we are aware of, that we can present our, sort of our stake in any particular issue in a way that other people can hear more clearly, and we can seek the same from them. So what I, the way that I kind of look at conventionally how we approach change is that we, we tend to tell or force people with sticks and carrots to comply with our wishes. And this is, what we've grown up with, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of us, I believe, were raised with parents who tend to, you get a penalty if you don't listen, or else someone's like, I'll give you an extra cookie if you do this for me. Like, we learned pretty early on that it's the sticks and carrots that we, learn how to respond to and navigate. And there are rules in society for a reason, and there's punitive measures for a reason, and there's a free market with incentives for a reason. However, those kinds of shifts that take place as a result of those kinds of measures are rarely transformative or sustainable. They're usually sort of incremental because someone just passed that, this bill by a slim majority, and there's still a tremendous amount of opposition. And the next time the power dynamics change, those things are going to get undone. And so we end up stuck in these divisive places of looking at what's not working and what someone didn't do, as opposed to what I am hoping for is a more mindful approach to change, which I call conscious social change. And this paradigm, first, it starts with our own capacity to be self-aware, because when we bring, as we were discussing earlier, we bring that awareness of how change is difficult and what drives our behaviors to the table, we're a little bit more compassionate about other people that we keep trying to change. Then we're curious. We bring the same curiosity that we cultivate in mindfulness to the way in which we relate with other people. We actually want to understand the diversity of viewpoints. We believe that everyone has something unique, a unique perspective to offer that's worthwhile, that we work inclusively in a way that would invite their participation so that we can diagnose these issues and get to the bottom of what people really need, as well as surface all of the great ideas. So getting our ego out of the way, which again is supported by mindfulness practice, we can actually hear what might be optimal instead of ramming our agenda down someone else's throat. And in the end, we come up with much more innovative and creative solutions that are likely to be more sustainable, because everyone feels like they've had a stake in the process and have a sense of ownership over its outcomes. And that's a whole different way of approaching it than just trying to get somebody to do what you want.
I think that that what you have to offer through your websites and your books, critically important at this juncture in our civilization. You and others like you who are seeking that change you're leading the way. And obviously you talk about leading from within. There's a space that, and I quote this poem pretty regularly on this program, and I paraphrase. I don't do the whole thing because it's a long one. Basically, the gods, they're getting really worried that man is beginning to figure out who he is and how he got here and basically getting the answers to his questions, you know, universal questions, if you will, and his ability to create and so forth. And so they start talking about hiding that secret. And they, oh, put it on a mountaintop. No, no, no. He'll find a way to climb it. We'll bury it down in the depths of the ocean. No, no, he'll find a way to get down there. And they go through a litany of different places where they'll put it. And finally, one of them chimes up and says, ah, let's hide it in his heart. He'll never look there. And I was sharing this with and interviewing Noah Benchia. He's a local resident here and a philosopher and so forth and a poet. And we were talking about this in that regard. And it's absolutely true in the sense that even when you talk about mindfulness in the now, you have to go within yourself. And if you want change out externally, you have to be the change internally, as we many times quote and or paraphrase Gandhi. But some folks, they just don't have the patience. Are there ways in which you encourage and as well as invite people to do that, to go within that? That doesn't make it, because I would venture some people find that it could be scary, because most of us, even though it's our inside, we don't know what's in there. It's like a dark black hole, and not quite the black hole of outer space that you get sucked into, although that is possible, I suppose. But there's this darkness, and we don't know what's in there. And do we bring a small little Bic lighter, or do we bring in giant, you know, generator-powered floodlights that they use on construction sites to try to see what's inside of us? Can you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. So I kind of have a process that I use that gives me key questions that help me through this process of becoming more aware. And it's really easy. It's not easy. Everything is hard in this work, but it can be applied on kind of a momentary moment by moment process. So the first thing is to have a simple practice that you do every day or at certain times. And I like to suggest this three breaths that I mentioned earlier. If you notice that you're getting triggered, or you're starting to get frustrated or irritated, or there's something happening for you emotionally that's not like just normal and equilibrium, you take three breaths. That is the first step in giving yourself pause and noticing what is actually taking place in that moment. And I assure you, if you do this in a heated argument, it actually can diffuse some of the energy, or at least the other person's wondering what in the world's going on. So with these three breaths, then you have a chance to ask yourself a few questions. The first question is, what is happening? And so what is happening? And you kind of give yourself a chance to look on three levels in yourself. What is happening in my body? Like, oh, I'm really tensing up right now. I'm holding my breath. What is happening in my heart? I'm feeling angry or vulnerable, you know, or what's happening in my mind. I'm remembering the time that somebody else really made me angry because they took advantage of me. Like, you just, and the more you do this, the more you'll go down layers and layers of what's happening. So the first step is simply noticing what is happening. The second question is, what is true? And this is where we go deeper than just a momentary recognition, to kind of ask, like, what is our stuff here that needs attending to or attention? You know, oh, this is me, you know, feeling like I'm out of control and I really like having control. Or this is me recognizing something that's unfair. You know, it's, you know, what is my piece in this issue, you know, as you look at what's really true, we could see, well, yeah, maybe I was a little impatient there, or maybe I am getting more, I have more invested in this situation than normal because of this reason. Like, we go and figure out what's at the roots of the situation by asking what is true. And then the third question is, what is needed? You know, what do I need right now? I need to take a step away, or I need to apologize, or I need to take some time to think about this. And then what is helpful is the fourth question. And that's where we don't impose all the time, you know, our way of fixing everything, but that we look at what is our unique role to play in this situation, this circumstance, whatever is happening. And that leads us to the fifth question, which is, what is possible? Because there's so much that becomes possible when we are able to be open-minded, take responsibility for our piece of the picture, and begin to work in a way that's collaborative. So I want to share one single quick story about what that looks like in action. A woman that we're working with in Rwanda. So in Rwanda and Uganda, I work with really disadvantaged undereducated women who have ideas for change. And we teach them a lot of these mindfulness skills, as well as we teach them how to start their own nonprofits to do change in a more mindful way. And one of the practices is this three breaths. So I, you know, ask the next day in class, has anyone been practicing this or had a chance to use it outside the classroom? And a woman raised her hand and she said, you know, I went home after class yesterday and I found that my kids had totally messed up the house. And I was so angry because usually I, you know, I work so hard. I don't have time to clean twice, you know, and usually I just, you know, I would just beat my children because of it. But this time I remembered what you said and I took three breaths. And I was able to realize that I don't want to hit my children. I just want them to listen to me. And I was able to explain to them why I wanted the house cleaned up. And you know what? They fixed it. And I didn't have to spank my kids. And I was thinking to myself, you know, thank goodness this is actually working in a very concrete way. But what was even more profound is that she was working on a nonprofit that was dealing with domestic violence. And for the first time in that single moment of taking three breaths, she realized how hard it is to change automatic behavior that results in violence. And for the first time, she realized how critically important it is for parents to embody this if they want these cycles to end in the next generation. And so when she came back to work on her venture, she and her team decided to shift the way in which they were working with just couples, to then be able to engage parents in how they were raising their kids, especially boys. And so that simple act of taking three breaths allowed her to notice what was happening, you know, what was really true in that moment, what she needed, and then how to take that in a helpful way back into creating a whole new possibility for her work.
Well, I have to tell you, first of all, that the nine questions completely obliterates the ability of an individual to say, but I was right. I was right. You, when you start asking those five questions, you have to let that one go, because we are here together and there is no abdicating responsibility. I used to think about that when I was working over in Phoenix for the Christian station, and I would hear this whole business about, oh, if bad things happen, it was the devil. And if good things happen, it was God. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, hold on a second. Then I'm a puppet on a string being manipulated by forces I don't understand, and I don't believe that. It just doesn't make any logical sense.
Well, we have free will.
Exactly. And then the other part of it is, and you're either 100% responsible or you're not. It's like being pregnant, which I've never been. But I know that either you're pregnant or you're not. There's no in between. So we have to get to that place. We're going to get to another place, and that's a break in just a moment. I want to let you folks know that we're talking with Gretchen Key Steidel, and we're talking about mindfulness. We're talking about leading from within, conscious social change, and mindfulness for social innovation. And we're also wanting you to check out the website, which is consciousocialchange.org, as well as the website globalgrassroots.com. I knew eventually I would get it. Globalgrassroots.org. And we're gonna, I think we're going to continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Please stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
All right, I have regrouped Richard Dugan along with Gretchen Key Steidel, and we're talking about mindfulness. We're talking about social change, and obviously that begins within each one of us. Let me address because you dove right into it near the end of our last segment. You're working with these women in Rwanda. First of all, why that specific part of the world? I've heard the stories, I watched the movie about the atrocities, and there's an observation that I have made about almost every documentary I've seen about the people of Africa who are struggling and just barely making it through, living on maybe a dollar a month or something. I don't know what the statistics are. But one of the things I've noticed, in spite of all of the seeming despair around them, first of all, I notice the clothing that they're wearing, 9 times out of 10, is extremely brightly colored. It blows me away that, and I don't know, maybe that was done for the cameras. I don't know. I'd like to think not. And many of the folks there, in spite of this despair, do have this undercurrent of optimism, that they want more. How did you connect with the folks, the gals in Rwanda?
Well, I had originally wanted to work on trying to help social ideas spread more quickly. And I thought that this would take a very top-down approach, where it was a matter of getting more corporate and government investment in the ideas of social entrepreneurs, and that I should just go in and broker that and convince everybody that that was important. So I took myself to South Africa first to travel around and looking at the issue of HIV/AIDS. And I figured people would care because at the time, this was 2004, the epidemic was at such a height that some companies were hiring 3 workers for the same job because 2 would be dead by the end of the year. And I traveled around the whole country visiting with corporate executives and experts. And somebody finally said, you know, have you actually been into the townships to talk with someone suffering from HIV/AIDS? And I hadn't. I didn't know how to do that. And so this particular person, a social entrepreneur, invited me in to meet this amazing woman. Her name was Zuleka Natuli. And she invited me to her 2-room metal shack to talk to her about the issue. And she taught me so much about the circumstances of HIV/AIDS. And it wasn't that people didn't know, especially women, how to protect themselves from HIV/AIDS. It was that they had such economic vulnerability and so few sexual rights that they couldn't navigate their own needs. Except in this particular case, Zuleka was committed to doing something about it. I mean, this was such a taboo topic. People were getting stoned to death if they were revealing their status. But when a 12-year-old girl was raped by her 12-year-old boyfriend and his friends, she realized that sexual violence and potentially then the spread of HIV had reached the level of children. There's a huge sexual violence epidemic that was fueling as well the spread of HIV, and she knew she had to act. So without any resources, no education, and no formal employment, She figured out how to use some of her skills making beaded products to put herself through counseling training and started gathering people together to start talking about the issue. And when I met with her, she had this group of 45 people, including a third of the men, working collaboratively, meeting three times a week and making major inroads on this issue of both sexual violence and HIV transmission, at making significantly greater change than some of the big executives that I was talking with. And I realized in that moment that in many cases, women bear the burden of these challenges, of these issues, and certainly of war and conflict. But they're the ones usually with the least access to the training and the resources to be able to advance their own ideas. And here, Zuleka couldn't go down to an internet cafe and look up a grant. She wasn't computer literate. She was just doing it as resourcefully and creatively as she could. And in that aha moment, I dedicated myself to wanting to support those emerging women change agents wherever they were, to help them with the ideas that they wanted to pursue themselves, their own solutions, not mine. And through a number of different tangents, I ended up working in Rwanda and later northern Uganda, primarily because I wanted to work post-conflict where women were really the ones tasked with rebuilding the fabric of society, where they had ideas of what was needed to fix their communities, to change the society that had failed to protect them from war and violence, and were not being consulted on what was most needed. And that's where we've been able to invest our energies over the last 12 years.
An observation that I made some years ago when I started hearing about atrocities towards women in not just Africa, but in the Middle East and other parts of the world where they're being prevented from getting an education and just living their lives and, of course, all of the abuses. And the thought occurred to me that, and it's obviously men who are preventing them from doing this, I'm thinking, boy, these men must really be frightened of these women. And if they had the education to do so, what they would do if given the chance. And I'm sitting here thinking, I was born and raised in a family with four sisters. And each one of them pursued, I think each one of them actually went to university, Arizona State University in particular, but they continued. And I think one or two of them still continuing to get their education. I think one of my sisters has, I think she has her master's in education. And those kinds of things are not easy. I've been working here at this station here in Santa Barbara, and I've known a number of people who've gone after their PhDs. I actually sat in on a PhD presentation. I can't remember the name of it, but where you have to defend your thesis and so forth. And it's pretty darn arduous. I mean, and of course, they're talking about it for a year or more. One guy who is a good friend of mine showed me his thesis. And the thing is, like, it's a book is what it is. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Wow. Education, you know, if you can't, and I say this with all due respect to folks, I've said this before. I think that remedial courses in post-secondary education should be abolished. If you don't have the necessary education to go to higher education, to start pursuing your dreams, I'm not sitting here saying you don't get to go. No. And I'm not going to sit here blaming. I'm going to say, then we need to get you to that level so you can enter that facility, that institution of higher learning, so that you can hit the ground running and go after whatever it is that you want to go after. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm coming from. And somebody hollered at me saying, oh, you're a conservative Republican. I said, don't you ever say that again. Mm-hmm. No, I am not. But what I am is one who believes that we all need, and you and I, I'm sure, are very much similar in that we're constantly educating ourselves. Through your work with these women in Africa, your education about other cultures, about other peoples, is probably showing you that, oh my gosh, they might live here in East Africa, but they're the same as me. Right?
It's absolutely true. You know, I was so disturbed, for example, by the remarks of our president a few months ago, earlier this year, sort of dismissing all of Africa. And there is so much that I have learned from the change agents that I have worked with.
If I can quote him, because we're into the podcast, I believe he referred to it as a shithole.
It is true. And, you know, I've been working in Africa now for over 14 years, and what I have learned and what I know Africa is, and of course, you know, we never want to generalize across an entire continent, but for the most part, the common threads that I have seen and the people that I've had a chance to work with are humility and resilience. Despite living under such great hardship, there is extraordinary generosity and motivation to create change. There is a tremendous amount of resourcefulness, people who are able to use whatever access that they have to the things around them to make a positive difference. They're collaborative. There's a sense of working in community for community that is really powerful that I think that we've lost touch with in the U.S. in many ways. And they're visionary and wise. There's a great sense of learning from each other, and there are very valuable ideas that are incredibly creative, and when working under resourced circumstances, are innovative. Would be innovative in any environment. I mean, for me, it's been quite a privilege to work in these communities and to continue to learn from the change agents who know themselves, what they need, and how to do it. And you know, I think our role in any circumstance, especially with our opposition, is to ask, you know, what do I have to learn from this relationship and this circumstance, and
yeah,
to go about creating change in a way that honors that.
And I hear this phrase on occasion from different folks, and they say, "Oh, United States, it's the greatest country on the planet." And my next question to them is, where else have you lived? Have you lived anywhere else but this country? And why do you think it is that the immigrants are flooding across our southern borders, let alone other people from other parts of the world, are going through the process of becoming naturalized U.S. citizens? Obviously, they see something here. But if you haven't lived anywhere else, what have you got it to compare to? When I watch, we watch Sky News out of the UK, and every half hour they go to a nonverbal global weather scan, and they rotate the globe and they show you where everything is. And I always see this huge mass of rain across Central Africa, and I envy them because we don't get enough here in Southern California and Central California. But I often wonder when the globe is spinning around about the peoples of those parts of the world that they're showing at that moment, you know, whether it's Africa, whether it's the Middle East and Europe and I'm not even sure what to call what was the former Soviet bloc, and the UK and Ireland and so forth. And then, of course, to China and Asia and Indonesia and all of the other parts of the world, and what people are doing right now, the kind of thing. And I find it fascinating how the internet has certainly brought us closer together, and so I thought would help us to better understand our brothers and sisters who are growing up in different cultures.
Yeah.
But yet, on the one hand, it probably has. But on the other hand, it's actually, in some instances, it's actually increased the divide. What do you, and by the way, social media is anything but social. When Noah Benchi and I were talking in our program the other day, he basically said that with technology, one of the biggest problems that we talked about was loneliness. And he says that with technology, the more people you connect with, the lonelier you get, because you're not really connecting with anybody. I'm on Facebook. I said that at the beginning of the program, right? But I only have friends that I know, family, literal friends. My best friend, who I grew up from grade school, high school, and college with, I am friends with him. my mother, my father, my sisters, my brother, et cetera, et cetera. Only people I know. If you were to send me a like, Gretchen, boom, I am your friend because I know you. I've had a chance to talk with you. But I get friend requests and I just delete them. And I tell people that. I said, I'm sorry, but I'm just not going to play that game. And I like nothing. I mean, I don't click like for anything for anybody because I just don't. I don't have the time. I mean, I've got other things like doing these interviews. You know, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, Gretchen, I got to cut this short because I got to go and I got to like a bunch of stuff on Facebook. No. But what are your thoughts in regards to humanity's future? And you and I would agree we're all connected, whether we had the internet or not. I mean, the internet could disappear today. Okay. We would still be connected one to another. We impact one another.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about that in terms of our connectedness, in terms of this whole aspect of social change. Is that a topic? Is that a factor that you talk about with in many of the gatherings where you speak? To let people know that, you know, you're not, A, you're not alone, and B, your actions don't just affect you.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think the more that you practice self-awareness and sort of tapping into your own inner wisdom, the more you recognize that. And so it's the more you cultivate compassion, the more you deeply connect with, feel, and understand other people. So it's an outgrowth of an investment in self-awareness that we recognize our connection with other people. And that extends in so many different ways. One, we have something to learn from every circumstance. And anyone, Pema Chodron, one of the people that I've found quite inspiring in her teachings and readings, will say, you know, think about anyone who sort of comes into contact with you in your life, especially those that are most difficult, like they have something to teach you. And so you kind of look at the world a little differently, and we start to learn what it is that we have to learn from each other as we go, and how these unique ways in which we are in contact with each other are opportunities. You know, not always just happenstance, but it is the opportunities to grow and transform and learn. The choices that we make in every moment have real consequences. And I teach this kind of work at a university level as well, and I've got students who will say, now that I'm mindful of everything, I don't even know how do I, like hold all of this awareness. It's, like, too much. You know, now I'm seeing the homeless guy, and I'm thinking about, like, what I'm drinking and how I'm throwing away my trash. Like, it's a lot. It's a lot to take into consideration. You know, every item of clothing that you buy came from somewhere, and every item of food you eat got processed in a certain way. And there are many different decisions that have an impact on the planet and other people. And while it's not up to us to fix every single thing, we can begin to make choices that are more in alignment with the values that we feel are most important, and to go about things more consciously, and to recognize that our choices, our actions, and our words do have consequences. And so we bring mindfulness into all of those spaces as we, you know, as we go forward.
Well, I first of all, I am very grateful that you're out there doing the work that you're doing. And eliciting the support, not just of organizations, but of individuals to become mindful. I am going to work on it myself in that regard because, you know, I mean, we all have all kinds of stuff going on in our lives. You know, we just got through tax season. California, Central California in particular, our tax season went on until the end of April because of all of the stuff that we went through. I'm going to just put it that way. We went through a lot of stuff in 2017, okay? And it had nothing to do with Washington. and so we've got that. And then you're trying to get the rent paid or the mortgage paid. And we've got to do this and all of these different things. And we've got animals that da-da-da. And boy, it is so easy to get drowned in all of that stuff. And you talk about these kids who, you know, as you said, become so mindful. It's like, oh, it's just, it's overwhelming. I used to hear the phrase that, what do you want to do? I want to change the world. But when you say that, it's like, it's so monumental. It's like you give up. I can't change the world. Well, no, you can't change the world in one giant bite. You've got to do it little tiny bites at a time. Mm-hmm. Take on what you can. If that means donating to a respective charity or organization. And that's another thing, too. I always found the whole, in this country, the whole tax incentive for charitable giving to be so disingenuous of those people who were giving. I mean, it's great for the nonprofits. But it's like, are you giving because you really, really, really are passionate and supporting this organization? Are you doing it so you don't have to pay as much in taxes?
Right. It goes back to intention.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the whole aspect of the power in words. And as I said, we've talked about that a lot. And some of the words that we're looking at here today, of course, are having to do with conscious social change. And it is a design philosophy and methodology blending mindfulness and with creativity, compassion, problem solving, and solution building. And I have to say that that's one of the things that I find missing in the media in the U.S. today is, again, as you pointed out as well, you know, pointing fingers and blaming and complaining and moaning and groaning. And if they offer solutions, I can't hear it over the whining. You know, if there were ever a solution that was ever offered, I can't hear it over the complaining and the moaning and the groaning. Mm. And so it's like, stop it. You know, I realize that's what makes ratings, in a lot of circles, but, you know, it doesn't make change. It just keeps things the way they are and keeps people miserable. And I have to wonder sometimes when we get into those states ourselves where we're complaining about our tax bill or the grocery bill or you know, whatever else is going on outside of us, how much dis-ease we're causing ourselves, which counters any kind of internal change that we're trying to accomplish to elicit external change. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, if we are able to take responsibility for our own role in the system, you know, we have to understand the way the system works by going more deeply into examining the roots and examining ourselves and what role we play in that. And if we're willing to take responsibility for that, then there's no point in doing all of the complaining and finger pointing, but it is a process of understanding then what is my role in change and how can I understand the problem better? How can I work more collaboratively and inclusively and ensure diversity of viewpoints and ideas? And how do we constructively move towards positive change? You know, we wouldn't look at compromise as a weakness anymore. We're not focused on simply winning. That's all about ego. And the complaints is about claiming victimhood. Instead, we are empowered and we know we have choice and there is a role to play and we feel responsible, but we also know it's not all up to us to fix. So we have healthy boundaries about ensuring our well-being so that we can do the work in the world, but without imposing ourselves on others. And, you know, and in doing that, we're way more likely to get to a place of transformation for society and ourselves than if we just sit around complaining about it all.
Tell me about the toolkit for conscious social change.
Well, so in my book, I wanted to share the stories and the philosophies of conscious social change. Now, how do you use mindfulness to create positive social change? What's the research and why does this really matter? Why is it relevant? But there are so many practices and tools that you can utilize in doing that, and it couldn't fit in the main book. And so I have created a toolkit for conscious social change that shares a lot of the frameworks and the practices and skills that I teach in my curriculum, both at Global Grassroots and that I do in private and other workshops for the general public and at universities. And so it's a chance, if you're a change agent or you're someone who's trying to work in community around an issue that you care about, you know, it could be school budgets, it could be race relations, it could be immigration issues. There is a way to take these tools and go through a methodical process of trying to solve them together. And so that's what's in my toolkit.
And in addition to that, you have two other things we'll touch upon before we wrap up the program here. You described mindfulness and the mindfulness meditation and so forth. But you also make available to folks on ConsciousSocialChange.org an opportunity. You provide them an opportunity to learn mindfulness. There are 10 steps and actually 10 videos. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I have a training program that I do to certify people in this methodology. And it used to be to train people to come and work with global grassroots as their trainers, and now it's much more generally focused. And it starts with basic mindfulness practices, because we really need to practice it and embody it before we can share it with other people. And so the first 10 practices that I share on a weekly basis in these courses I do are there as video guided meditations on my website. So if you want to try them, they're simple practices, but it's a chance to let someone else speak to you so that you don't have to just kind of navigate on your own, and just listen and practice, you know, these series of practices. Maybe one of them in particular really resonates with you, and that's the one that you can start using as your main practice.
Great stuff. And there's even more on the website as well. We encourage you to go there. And also encourage you to go to the website globalgrassroots.org, and that is globalgrassroots.org, to find out more about the work that that Gretchen is doing in Rwanda. Gretchen, I'm excited about the work that you are doing, and that we're a part of that now by virtue of this interview, and I look forward to hearing more from you. I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us on this program about conscious social change, as well as working with these gals in Rwanda. And you know, who knows, one of these gals, I think, you know, you talked earlier about this, and there was a great example I was thinking of Nelson Mandela, who, when he went to prison for 25 years, he had a choice to make. Did he continue going down the path he was going, or did he go a different way? Well, he went a different way, wound up being president of South Africa. Who knows where these women are going to wind up in the years to come? And I have to tell you, that actually is a very exciting thought. To think that these women could be the next generation of, and I'm going to call them servants of the people in government, because that's what they're supposed to be in the first place. And I mean, people who are elected are supposed to be servants of the people, helping of the people. And I think that's really great. And that you are having a part in that transformation, I think, is really exciting.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been such an honor to share this philosophy and my stories with you and your listeners.
Before we let you go, I have three final questions, and they are in order. First of all, who is Gretchen Key Steidel?
Who am I? That's a deep question. Well, I'm a social entrepreneur and a mindfulness teacher who believes deeply in the fact that outer transformation comes from inner transformation. So that's my passion, bringing this work to the world. But I'm also a mother of a young daughter, and you know, another place where I learned some of my greatest lessons are from her.
Mm. I know, too, that some programs we've had on talking about the feminine energy that is sort of bubbling up, the divine feminine energy especially, and this is not about overthrowing the male energy. This is about collaborating and working together to resolve the issues and the problems that we've got. So you're on your way. I can tell you that right now. Second question is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would like to see people embracing mindfulness work as a design tool for social change. There's a lot of talk of mindfulness now, and that is fantastic. And the more people who are practicing it, the more self-aware we are, the more we're going to feel connected and compassionate, and the more we're going to do the work for ourselves. But it goes beyond that. And I would like for people to realize that these are tools for solving problems, and that if we don't invest in this kind of way, inner-driven way, we're not going to get the sustainable transformation that we're looking for in society. So that is what I hope will come of this book and this work, is that a group of community members will say, gosh, we have this really intractable problem we're working on. Why don't we take this next step, to take this process, to see what outcomes come from approaching this in a whole different way than we always have. And I hope that we'll see some really powerful innovation come from it.
Optimistic, to say the very least. And final question is, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is to support personal transformation. And whether that's teaching my daughter how to navigate the world in front of her and know herself and have her voice so that she can find her purpose and meaning, bringing these kinds of mindfulness tools to change agents so that they can be better prepared to advance the change that they want to see in the world, or supporting other people in doing the deep inner work that they need to take the next step in their lives. That's what I feel dedicated towards.
ConsciousGlobalChange.com, I beg your pardon, that's ConsciousSocialChange.com, as well as GlobalGrassroots.org. And the book entitled Leading from Within, Conscious Social Change and Mindfulness for Social Innovation. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Gretchen Key-Steidel, and we thank you again, Gretchen, for joining us here on the program. And we look forward to having you back again. And if you're in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio, because this conversation needs to continue.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.